pinned face down on the floor, his energy rifle stripped from his hands, with the weight of two fully armored Dusan soldiers on his back. A second later, he felt a sharp pain in his leg, after which everything went black. Crispin stepped out of the taxi at the gate to the Scott family compound outside of Vancouver. He walked up to the line of six people still waiting to be cleared through the front gates by NAU security.
"Catering staff?"
the man at the end of the line asked him.
"Yes,"
Crispin replied. "Terence," the man said, introducing himself.
"Martin,"
Crispin replied, shaking the man's hand.
"What do you do?"
"I don't know. They haven't told me."
"I'm a bartender. I'm excited I got this gig. The crowd will be full of rich bigwigs. Tip should be great."
"I wouldn't know," Crispin admitted. "This is my first time."
"And you got this gig?"
Terence laughed.
"Man, you must know someone. That or you're luckier than hell."
"I think I was just lucky," Crispin insisted. "Right place, right time, and all that."
"Pray that you get waitstaff," Terence said. "Busboys and food servers never get squat, but waitstaff and bartenders clean up at parties like this."
"Really?" Crispin said, feigning interest. "How much do you think I could make?"
"I'll probably make at least 1,000,
Terence bragged. "But I've been at this a while. I wouldn't be surprised if you walked away with a few hundred at least."
"That would be nice," Crispin lied. "I could use the money."
The latter wasn't really a lie. Although Mr. Dakota had promised financial payment in addition to freedom for himself and Sarah, one could always use extra cash. He had been living on a company credit card, whose company he did not know. He was always worried that those who had hired him might suddenly change their minds, and he'd be on the run with no cash in his pocket. At least if he had a little cash, it would give him options in case something went horribly wrong. Crispin watched as one by one the people in line before him were scrutinized by the NAU security personnel. Their IDs were checked, their bioscans were checked against the national and global registries, and they were questioned for several minutes before being allowed to advance to the next station further down the walkway. When it was Crispin's turn, it was no different. IDs, bioscan, and the usual questions. Where are you from? Where are you staying? How did you get this job? Where were you born? Have you ever served in a military unit? Have you ever been convicted of a crime? Once he cleared the first station, the same process was repeated at the second station. The same checks and the same questions. Only this time, the interrogator was likely checking his answers against those given a few minutes ago. But Crispin had been mentally rehearsing his profile for the entire trip from Winnipeg, and his answers, although worded slightly differently so as not to appear rehearsed, were the same.
"You made it,"
Terence congratulated, waiting for him just past the second security checkpoint.
"Are we going to have to go through that every time we report for work?"
Crispin asked for appearance's sake.
"To be honest, I have no idea. I've never worked anything presidential. It's pretty crazy, isn't it?"
"Yeah, crazy," Crispin agreed, following his new friend toward the main house. He felt a little bad for Terence. He seemed like a genuinely nice fellow, and under different circumstances they might actually have become friends. But after this was all over, poor Terence would likely find himself the subject of intense interrogation for having been friends with a man who assassinated the President of the North American Union and the leader of the Earth and the Soul Alliance. Only 30 minutes later, Burke, Cuddy, and Michael found themselves being escorted through the corridors of a local jail, which had been turned into a Dusan holding facility. As they passed the various cells, Michael recognized more faces than he cared to. In addition to ex-Cor Nari, the Dusan had been busy rounding up as many resistance members as they could track down. One face in particular nearly caused Michael to do a double-take, which would have clued the Dusan that he knew the man. The Dusan guard shoved the three of them into the very next cell with enough force to nearly knock Burke to his knees in the process. Michael took a seat on the side of the cell nearest the man he had recognized in the next cell over. He did not make eye contact, again not wanting to tip the Dusan to his recognition of the man. But it was difficult not to look at his old friend, for he had obviously been beaten severely and quite recently.
"Hello, Michael," the man said.
Michael's eyes widened, darting around to see if the Dusan had noticed.
"It's okay," the man said. "They already know who we are and that we know one another."
"Holy shit," Cuddy exclaimed. "You're Jonas Pritchett."
Michael cast a disapproving look at Cuddy.
"It's all right," Jonas assured Michael. "They know everything, who we are, what we've been doing, what we've done. How? Michael wondered.
They have a device, Jonas explained. It makes it impossible to lie. If you lie, you feel pain. Incredible pain. Pain like you've never imagined.
When you say they know everything, do you mean...
Yes. They know the communication algorithm and the encryption codes, Jonas explained. Like I said, everything.
Then it's over, Michael realized, slumping back against the wall.
We've failed.
I'm afraid so.
I don't understand, Cuddy said. How did they find everyone?
Through the comm links you created, Jonas explained.
What? That's impossible, Cuddy insisted.
That algorithm was hard-coded into the devices, Burke reminded them. There's no way they got the encryption codes from the comm units we made.
You're right, they didn't, Jonas explained. They used them to track down the users and then ourselves.
But
it's not your fault, Jonas assured him, cutting Cuddy off mid-sentence. They left the old nets open on purpose to lure us into using them. If you hadn't come up with the idea, another of us would have sooner or later. They have been monitoring everything, and they have far more satellites watching over all of Coronair than we were led to believe.
Jonas Pritchett leaned his head back, closing his eyes. He was obviously still in considerable pain.
They've been playing us all the entire time. They're a lot smarter than we originally thought, definitely smarter than the Jung ever were.
Michael noticed the pain Jonas was experiencing.
If they can make you tell the truth, why did they beat you?
For fun, I guess.
The sick bastards, Cuddy exclaimed. Be careful, Michael warned. They could be listening.
I doubt it, Jonas told him. They have no need to.
Jonas drew in a deep breath and then shouted, The Dusan are a bunch of Asani beetles.
Jonas laughed, which immediately caused him pain, but the look on his face indicated that it had been worth it.
You see, nothing.
Aren't you afraid they'll beat you some more? Cuddy wondered.
Nope, they can't. Not without killing me. And they can't afford to do that, at least not yet. They still have a lot of information they need to get out of me.
What shall become of us? Michael wondered.
They will offer you a choice, Jonas replied. Serve them or spend the rest of what will probably be a short life at hard labor.
Michael leaned his head back and sighed.
Sorry, guys, he told Burke and Cuddy.
Burke and Cuddy exchanged concerned looks, but said nothing, as they too leaned back against the wall in resignation.
Mr. Yokima, Minister Seberon welcomed as he came out from behind his desk to offer a proper greeting.
Minister, Ito greeted in kind, bowing respectably.
I trust you are well, the minister said after bowing in return.
My recovery is progressing nicely, thanks to the nanite treatments given to me by the Aurora's medical staff.
Quite remarkable technology, those nanites, Minister Seberon praised.
He gestured to the two sitting chairs near the large picture window.
Please. The two men took their seats, with Ito pausing to allow the old minister to sit first, as Rakuan culture required.
A stunning view, Ito remarked as he took his seat. The gardens are especially vibrant this time of year, the minister agreed. But surely you did not call on me to take advantage of my view of the gardens.
I did not, Ito admitted.
Respectfully, minister, I was wondering about your reluctance to join the Karazari Alliance. I was hoping you could share your reasoning so that I might understand the situation better.
Straight to the point and with tact and respect, Minister Seberon commented, his smile hiding his annoyance that the brash businessman felt his wealth and fame gave him the right to question a duly elected minister of Rakuin.
I can see why you have excelled in your business endeavors.
I assure you I mean no disrespect, minister. I would not normally presume such privileges. However, my sudden increase in celebrity has placed additional pressures upon me. People are asking for my opinion on the matter. They are asking if I agree with your reluctance to accept Captain Scott's invitation. As of yet, I have not responded, but I cannot do so forever. Eventually, I will be forced to comment, and I would prefer to do so intelligently. As an experienced statesman, I am certain you are considering various consequences, both long and short term, that I could not possibly anticipate. I would very much like to support you publicly, however, based on my current understandings, I find it difficult to do so. I'm happy to explain my position to any constituent, the minister responded, regardless of their socio-political standings, he added, making sure that his guest knew he was well aware of the businessman's political aspirations. He folded his hands in his lap and began his speech. As you are aware, the introduction of jump-drive technology into the Pantoris, Injin, and Rogan sectors has caused considerable change in Rakuan society. Systems which were once outside our sphere of influence have now become partners in our economy. Tourism alone has tripled in recent years. Your company is a prime example of the economic benefits of instant interstellar transit, as your profits have grown exponentially now that so many more markets are available.
All of this is true, Mr. Yokima agreed. But if you will excuse my ignorance, I fail to see the connection.
While the boon to the economy of Rakuan is indeed welcome, it comes with its own dangers, one of which is the dilution of Rakuan culture and traditions. As you know, our world was founded by those who wished to prevent such dilution. I myself was elected by those traditionalists, as I share their same fears. While I cannot stop the interstellar connectivity caused by jump-drive technology, nor should I wish to, I can and I must prevent associations that might damage our culture, our way of life, and our very world. Mr. Yokima took a slow, deep breath while he assessed the minister's words and carefully formulated a response.
While I applaud your concern for our culture and our world, I fear that such associations, despite their inherent risks, are unavoidable in light of our new interstellar connectivity.
Perhaps, the minister acquiesced, but would it not be prudent to avoid such risks for as long as possible, especially risks that have already been demonstrated to be true? But by avoiding a distant threat, are you not creating an equal one within our own system? Ito reminded him. Neramis has been our ally because they needed us to protect them after they were stripped of all military forces by their surrender. Now they will be given the technology necessary to defend themselves. Technology that can be used offensively as well against Rakuan.
Of this I am well aware, Minister Sebron assured his guest. Are you also aware that should the Dusan attack the Rogan system again, the Karuzari Alliance, while defending Neramis, will not be obligated to defend Rakuan?
Legal obligations are not necessarily the same as ethical ones, Minister Sebron explained. Especially when you consider that many of our Ganyoki fighters will be in the service of the Karuzari Alliance. Do you really think they would stand by and witness the destruction of their homeworld? Do you really believe the Karuzari Alliance would risk losing the support of those Ganyoki fighters by refusing to protect Rakuan during an assault on this system?
So you're attempting to obtain the protection of the Alliance while not directly inviting the wrath of the Dusan?
Minister Sebron nodded.
A dangerous gamble, Ito said. A clever one, I grant you, but dangerous nonetheless. Again, I must raise the question about the Neramisians. The balance of power within our system will be changed, and it will be in their favor.
I doubt the Karuzari Alliance will allow Neramis to attack Rakuan, Minister Sebron said. Such would not be in line with Captain Scott's moralities.
Then you believe him to be a man of peace and honor?
As much as I believe any man to be of such.
Do men of honor not stand for something? Ito asserted.
Do they not risk their own lives and fortunes for the good of all?
They do, Minister Sebron agreed. And is this also not the way of the Ganyoki? Ito reminded the minister.
When given no alternative, yes. However, I have found what I believe to be a reasonable alternative, one that balances risk and reward far better than simply joining the brave young men and women in shiny uniforms and standing against evil.
But the Dusan are evil, Ito argued. Surely you see that.
What I see is an entity that believes they are doing what is right for their people. It is quite possible, in fact, that they believe they are doing what is right for all people. After all, most leaders did not consider themselves to be wrong, nor did they consider themselves to be evil. Even those who knowingly committed atrocities against humanity usually believe that the ends justify the means.
But equipping our Ganyoki fighters with jump drives will greatly increase our ability to defend ourselves against not only the Dusan, but all else who may wish to impose their will upon us, Ito argued.
And we will get jump drives on our Gunyoki fighters even without joining the Karazari Alliance and declaring ourselves as enemies to the Dusan.
And what about the jump missile batteries? Ito asked. Without them, our fighters will not be able to defeat a full-on Dusan attack.
We can build our own jump missiles, Mr. Yokima. Jump drive technology is already available to us. It has been since Ronnie Enterprises filed for patent protection with our world.
That would be a violation of their patents, Ito insisted.
Need I remind you that in a time of crisis, all such patents are available for use by the Rakuen government?
That might work for the jump drive, Ito agreed. But how long will it take us to develop our own jump missile batteries?
Our spy network on Nermis is vast, Minister Seberon replied. And there is no shortage of Nermisians who would willingly provide us the information we need for the right payment. Just like the Dusan, we shall acquire what we need to ensure our survival.
Ito stared at the minister for a moment.
And you see nothing wrong with that. What I feel is right or wrong is of little consequence, Minister Seberon replied. My obligation is to ensure the well-being of the people of Rakuen, even if that means doing something that I consider to be legally, morally, or ethically wrong. That is what is required of a leader.
What is required of a leader is to adhere to the laws, ethics, and moralities of those he or she represents, Ito argued.
With all due respect, Minister, whether or not Rakuen should join the Karazari Alliance is not a matter for you alone to decide. It is a matter that the people of Rakuen should decide. In times of crisis and in times of war, Rakuen law grants the Ministry considerable latitude in such matters, Minister Seberon defended.
I am well aware of the details of Rakuen law, Minister, and I do not believe the current situation meets the criteria to grant your office such latitudes.
Mr. Yokima, the minister said, attempting to interrupt the younger businessman.
Ito chose to ignore protocol, refusing to yield to the elder statesman.
The intention of my visit this day was not to challenge you, Minister, but to understand you. Unfortunately, now that I do, I find that I have no choice but to oppose you, and to do so quite publicly. Furthermore, once the Karazari Alliance is made aware of your plans, I'm sure they will take precautions to ensure that Rakuen will be unable to gain access to jump missile battery technology.
Minister Seberon cast a menacing gaze at Ito.
I should warn you, Mr. Yokima, that your threats could be considered treasonous, and I would be well within my power to have you arrested this day.
And I should warn you, Minister, that both my wealth and my sudden increase in popularity among the people of Rakuen would make me a difficult adversary come to the next elections.
You threaten the inevitable, Mr. Yokima, the minister replied with a confident smile. You represent the youth of Rakuen, those who look to the stars from whence we came, instead of keeping their eyes and their hearts on what we have and protecting it for future generations. You represent the very attitudes that forced our forefathers to leave their world behind and start anew. I shall oppose you, Ito Yokima, with all of the resources available to me. That is why I was elected, and to those who elected me, I shall remain true.
Ito leaned forward, his own menacing look adorning his face.
You spoke of leaders believing the wrongs they committed were for the good of all. You spoke of the ends justifying the means. Perhaps you are right, Minister. Perhaps I, should I choose to become a leader, should do whatever is necessary to see that old men such as yourself, men who refuse to face the inevitable changes that progress will always bring, are removed from power and not allowed to destroy the futures of our children for the sake of the memories of their own glorious pasts.
Despite his utter disdain for his guest, Minister Seberon nodded respectfully.
I sense that you and I have reached an impasse, Mr. Yokima. As men of honor and as men who both care deeply about Rakuen, we shall both do what we believe to be best for our world.
Minister Seberon stood.
I believe you know the way out, Mr. Yokima. Good day.
With that, the minister cast one last insult to his guest and turned to walk away without bowing.
Ito sighed as he stood. He had hoped to convince the old statesman to see the error of his ways, but his failure came as no surprise.
The minister had opposed turning the Gunyoki into a competition, despite the dramatic increase in the number of combat-ready fighters that had resulted. Change was not something the elders of Rakuen took too lightly. Ito himself had been of their ilk only a few short weeks ago,
and it had nearly gotten him killed and his world destroyed. Captain Scott had given him a second chance, and he would not make that mistake again, even if it meant going up against all the elders of Raccoon. After spending nearly the entire day sitting in the corner of the cell, Michael rose and came over to stand before Burke and Cuddy. "May I?" he asked. Burke and Cuddy both slid apart, making room for Michael. "How's he doing?" Cuddy asked. "Jonas will be fine," Michael replied as he sat down between them. "He is strong. All Koronari are, much stronger than I." "You're not Koronari, are you?" Cuddy surmised. "I am not. I wish I could have been, but they were disbanded before I returned from the Soul Sector. I like to think that I am of the same ilk, but I have not been through the same training nor shared the bonds that make them unique among all of humanity's warriors." Michael gazed across the cell, as if looking at something far beyond the walls that imprison them. "I only hope that I have earned the respect of those Koronari with whom I have fought." After a moment, Michael turned his attention back to the present. "The two of you remind me much of myself when I was your age. I, too, was left with a choice to serve or to suffer incarceration for what might remain of my young life." He looked at Cuddy. "There is no shame in choosing to survive." He then looked at Burke. "For one cannot know what good one might do if given an opportunity." He looked forward again. "Sometimes surviving is the only way we can fight. The time may come when you too are given an opportunity to make a difference. But if you're not alive to seize that opportunity, you might miss the only chance you ever had to truly make a difference." "How can anyone know such an opportunity will come?" Cuddy wondered. "We cannot know," Michael admitted. "We can only survive and hope that such an opportunity comes to us, to give our lives meaning. I got my opportunity, and I took it. For that I have no regrets, despite the fact that doing so led me here to this day and to the bleak future before me." "Then you're planning to refuse to serve them?" Cuddy realized. "I have no choice." "You're not Koronari," Burke reminded him. "You said so yourself. You won't be breaking any oaths if you agree to serve the Dusan." "What about all that talk about opportunities and staying alive to make a difference?" Cuddy argued. "The Dusan would never trust me to serve them," Michael pointed out. "As a soldier or a slave, they will make my life a living hell." Michael sighed. "I will stand by the Koronari and refuse to serve the Dusan, but the two of you need to not condemn yourselves to slavery. Neither of you has any record of military service, and you both were bullied into joining our ranks. If questioned using this truth device of theirs, you will likely pass, since the truth is that neither of you sought to join the resistance." "Maybe not," Burke agreed, "but we could have refused to join." "You are but young men," Michael told him, "still naive and lacking in conviction. Your involvement with the Koronari resistance was not by choice." "But," Michael looked Burke in the eyes, "can you honestly tell me that had you not feared for your life that day, you would have chosen to join our ranks?" "I do not lie to me," Michael warned. "No, I probably wouldn't have," Burke agreed. "But that doesn't mean I wouldn't have joined later." "And you?" Michael asked, turning to look at Cuddy. "I didn't want to try to sell the weapons to begin with," Cuddy admitted. "He talked me into it."
"You're never going to let me forget that, are you?" Burke moaned.
Jail cell," Cuddy reminded his friend. "So you see, there is no need for you to face the same fate as the rest of us," Michael stated. "Your true purpose is still out there somewhere, waiting for you in the future. You both must live to find it and fulfill whatever fate has planned for you." Burke and Cuddy both thought for a moment.
"But how do we know that our true purpose isn't waiting for us as slaves with the rest of you?" Cuddy asked.
Michael smiled for the first time since their capture. "You don't. That uncertainty is what makes life interesting.
For all you know, another opportunity could be waiting for you as a slave of the Dusan," Burke told him.
Again, Michael smiled. "One can only hope." The three of them sat in silence for several minutes.
"What do you think they will do with all of you?"
Cuddy finally asked. "Probably send us to some mining camp and force us to work in conditions that will lead to our early demise," Michael replied.
"What will they do with us?"
Burke wondered, somewhat selfishly. "You will likely be brainwashed into believing in those you serve. Then you will be given training that suits your aptitudes and assigned somewhere within the ranks of the Dusan Empire. If you are lucky, you will climb in rank and possibly even carve out a nice little life for yourself. At worst, you will become sacrificial pawns in some meaningless battle to further the Empire."
"Some choice,"
Burke grumbled. "We all die eventually," Michael told him. "Few of us get to choose what we die for. If you refuse service now, you will die for nothing."
"If we agree to serve, we might still die for nothing,"
Cuddy pointed out.
"True, but you may not. And that one chance of someday making a difference. That, too, is an honorable way to live. Try to remember that, for yourselves and for the people of Coronair."
Nathan sat silently as Vladimir put a plate of something on the table in front of him.
Was the only thing that came out of his mouth.
"What is wrong?"
"I'm afraid."
Vladimir squinted, confused.
"Afraid of what?"
"What is what I'm trying to figure out."
Nathan turned the plate of food around 180 degrees, hoping that the other side might offer a hint of what it was.
"What is this?"
"I call it pasta a la Vladimir."
"Okay, so it has a name," Nathan replied, still examining the pile of food in front of him.
"And apparently it has pasta in it, somewhere. Actually, the pasta turns to mush at some point and sort of mixes in with the sauce."
"What are these brown things? Some kind of meat?" Nathan wondered.
"Oxa meat." "I never heard of it. It is a type of fish on Rakuin. It is very large and tastes sort of like beef."
"It doesn't smell like beef, that's for sure," Nathan replied.
"Why is it all mushy?"
he asked, scooping up a spoonful of the pasty, lumpy goop.
"I came up with this recipe on accident," Vladimir explained. "I was attempting to make stroganoff, but then Cameron decided to hold one of her famous poorly timed battle drills. I figured the drill would be over quickly, as usual, so instead of turning the stove off, I simply turned it down to a simmer. The drill went longer than expected, and by the time I got back, the pasta was like mush. I was so hungry by then that I just stirred in some meat and ate it. And it was good. Not as good as this, though. This took several more attempts to perfect. Now it is creamy, meaty goodness."
Nathan continued to stare at the creamy goop on the plate before him, picking at it with his spoon, hesitant to dig in. He watched as Vladimir attacked his plate of food without restraint, shoveling the goop into his mouth. Finally, Nathan took a deep breath and said,
"I guess if I can face the Dusan, I can face pasta a la Vladimir."
He took a spoonful and put it into his mouth, swallowing it without chewing.
"Huh,"
he said, a surprised look on his face. He scooped up another spoonful and ate it.
"It's not as bad as it looks."
After a third spoonful, he added,
"This isn't half bad. Weird, but tasty."
"I told you."
The accent lighting in the captain's mess suddenly turned red, and an alarm klaxon sounded in the corridor.
"General quarters! General quarters! All hands report to stations!"
"Unbelievable!"
Vladimir exclaimed, slamming a spoon down on the table.
"If this is another one of her drills..."
"This is not a drill."
Both Nathan's and Vladimir's eyes widened.
"I guess not," Nathan said, as he and Vladimir rose from their seats and headed for the exit.
"Captain, XL," Cameron's voice called over Nathan's comset.
"Sit rep,"
Nathan replied, tapping his comset. "Jump comm drone from Rakuin. They are under attack by Dusan gunships," Cameron explained over his comset as he moved quickly down the corridor and entered the outer entrance to the Aurora's bridge. "I've ordered all strikers to remain to cover the fleet," she continued as Nathan entered the bridge.
"Captain on the bridge,"
the guard announced as Nathan passed by him and headed to the center of the bridge. "We're changing course for Rakuin now," Cameron continued, rising from the command chair and stepping to starboard to make room for Nathan.
"First jump plotted and ready, sir,"
the Aurora's navigator reported.
"I'm headed for combat,"
Cameron stated as she turned toward the starboard exit.
"Weapons are coming online now,"
Jessica reported, having just entered the bridge and stepping in to replace the junior officer at the tactical station directly behind Nathan's command chair.
"Helm, get us to Rakuin," Nathan ordered.
"Best speed to Rakuin, aye,"
Lieutenant Denev confirmed as she completed the Aurora's change in course and speed.
"Jumping in three," the navigator began.
"All stations report general quarters,"
the communications officer announced.
"Two."
"Very well," Nathan replied.
"One."
"All weapons are charged and ready,"
Jessica reported.
"Jumping."
"Shields?"
Nathan asked, as the subdued jump flash filled the bridge.
"All shields at maximum,"
Jessica assured him.
"First jump complete,"
the navigator reported.
"Turning to 147, two down,"
Lieutenant Denev announced as she altered course for the next jump.
How much juice are we going to have left over, Mr. Bickle?
50% in each, sir,
the navigator replied.
More than enough.
Good to hear.
On course and speed for second jump,
the helmsman reported.
Very well, Lieutenant. Jumping in 3 seconds.
XO is in combat, the communications officer reported.
2. Tactical weapons free, Nathan ordered.
1.
Weapons free, aye,
Jessica acknowledged.
Jumping.
The subdued blue-white jump flash again washed over the Aurora's bridge as she jumped into the Rogan system near Raccoon.
Jump complete,
Ensign Bickle reported.
Multiple targets,
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported from the sensor station.
6 Doosan gunships and 2 frigates.
Targeting the frigates with jump missiles, Jessica reported.
2 each, launching.
Jump flashes, the Lieutenant Commander added.
4 Doosan octofighters directly astern, locking onto our aft shields.
Jump missiles away, Jessica reported.
Combat is dealing with the octofighters.
All gunships and frigates just jumped, the sensor officer reported.
Find them, Nathan ordered. Comms get a report from Raccoon Defense Command. I need to know what they're targeting, if anything.
Aye, sir.
Tactical launch all fighters, Nathan continued. Helm, let's not stay in any one place for too long. I don't want to get a Doosan jump missile up our ass.
8 Super Eagles are away, Jessica reported.
2 Raptors are clearing the port deck now.
Helm hard to starboard. Bring us to a jump line low across Raccoon, Nathan ordered.
Mr. Bickle ready a jump to the far side of Raccoon.
Hard to starboard, 10 down to skim low orbit, Lieutenant Deneve confirmed as she steered the ship to the right and slightly down, relative to the system ecliptic.
Captain?
Jessica questioned, wondering why Nathan was moving the ship to the other side of the planet.
Jump ready,
the navigator reported.
I have Raccoon Defense Command, Captain,
the comms officer announced. They report 4 gunships attacking the Rondi plant from orbit.
On the far side of Raccoon, Jessica realized.
I had a hunch, Nathan told her.
The plant has lost shields and is taking damage.
Jump us to the far side, Mr. Bickle, Nathan ordered.
Tactical jump missiles for the gunships, if you please.
RDC also reports 20 gun Yoki have been dispatched from the race platform, the comms officer continued.
ETA 2 minutes.
I've got the gun Yoki, the sensor officer reported.
Jumping,
the navigator reported as the jump flash washed over the bridge again. There will be nothing left of that plant in 2 minutes, Nathan said under his breath.
Jump complete,
Mr. Bickle reported.
Locking jump missiles on targets, Jessica reported.
Double-check all targets, Nathan advised. We don't want to take out any gun Yoki by mistake.
Not a chance, Jessica assured him.
Launching jump missiles.
Helm, turn us into those gunships and accelerate to max intercept speed. Take up station above the Rani plant, Nathan ordered.
Turning in and accelerating, aye, Lieutenant Deneve acknowledged.
Missiles away,
Jessica reported from the tactical station.
Where the hell are those frigates?
Nathan demanded as the planet slid into view from the lower right of the main view screen that wrapped around the forward half of the bridge.
Nothing in close, Captain,
Lieutenant Commander Kona replied from the sensor station.
I'm expanding my search perimeter.
4 jump flashes appeared in the distance directly ahead of them, one of which immediately changed from blue-white to reddish-orange.
Ours or theirs? Nathan asked.
Both, Jessica replied. 1 kill, the other 3 jumped away just as our missiles jumped in.
Caught one sleeping, Nathan commented.
8 more Super Eagles are away, Jessica added.
2 more Raptors are launching now, starboard side.
Captain!
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported with alarm.
I've got one of the frigates attacking the race platform.
Helm, get us to the race platform best speed, Nathan ordered.
Changing course for the race platform,
Lieutenant Deneve acknowledged from the helm.
Plotting jump, Mr. Bickle added.
Tactical lock a pair of jump missiles on that frigate and launch. She needs something to think about other than that race platform, Nathan continued.
You got it, Jessica replied.
Jump plotted and ready.
Comms tell RDC to keep all gun Yoki headed toward low orbit above the Rani plant. We'll deal with the frigates. And if they've got more gun Yokis available at the platform, tell them to launch now while they still can.
Coming on to new intercept course now, Lieutenant Deneve announced.
Missiles away, Jessica reported.
There's something wrong with that contact,
Lieutenant Commander Kona warned as she studied her sensor readings more carefully.
The energy signature is way too high.
Jumping, Mr. Bickle announced as the jump flash washed over the bridge again. When the jump flash subsided, there were suddenly 2 Doosan frigates in front of them. One of them was facing away from the Aurora and was firing on the race platform. The other was facing them.
Nathan's eyes widened.
Helm, hard to starboard, he ordered. The view screen filled with splashes of red-orange as incoming plasma cannon fire slammed into the Aurora's forward shields. The ship shook violently as four more explosions pounded them, as missiles that had been launched from the attacking frigate, even before the Aurora had jumped in, impacted their shields, weakening them further.
"Forward shields down to 20%,
the systems officer warned.
"Combat has all port cannons firing on the frigate,"
Jessica announced as the Aurora turned hard to starboard to escape the attacking frigate and get to a clear jump line. The Aurora continued to shake violently as both missiles and plasma cannon fire slammed into the forwardmost port shields, working their way aft to the midship shields and then the aft shields.
"Jump line is clear,"
Mr. Bickle reported, expecting the order to jump away from the incoming fire.
"Continue your turn," Nathan ordered. "We're not going anywhere."
"Holding my turn, aye,"
Lieutenant Deneuve replied confidently.
"Jump missiles on the frigate attacking the platform, Jess,"
Nathan ordered.
"Already locked,"
Jessica replied.
"Launching missiles."
"They'll jump away again,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona warned.
"Port shields all down 50%,
the systems officer warned.
"Missiles away,"
Jessica announced. "No, they won't," Nathan assured her. "Not if they have a chance to take us out. Be they Jung or Dusan, pride is their weakness."
"Direct impacts on Frigate One,"
Jessica exclaimed.
"Frigate One's starboard shields are down and she's lost half her starboard emitter array,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported.
"She's not jumping anywhere."
"Helm, continue your turn," Nathan ordered. "Bring our starboard broadside cannons to bear."
"Aye, sir,"
Lieutenant Deneuve replied.
"I'm picking up 8 more Gunyoki leaving the race platform,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona announced.
"Comms contact those fighters direct. Tell them to target Frigate One's starboard side and finish her off. We'll deal with Frigate Two."
"Aye, sir,"
the comms officer replied.
"3 enemy gunships have returned to their attack position above the Rani plant,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported.
"Gunyokis are still 30 seconds out."
"Tactical,"
Nathan began, but was cut short.
"Jump missiles locked on the gunships,"
Jessica announced, reading her captain's mind.
"Launching 4.
"Broadside's coming to bear,"
Lieutenant Deneuve reported.
"Shall I decelerate, Captain?"
"Missiles away,"
Jessica announced.
"Affirmative,"
Nathan replied as he tapped his headset. "Combat, Captain. Broadsides on Frigate 2. Fire at will."
"Broadsides, Frigate 2 firing,"
Cameron replied. Nathan tapped the control panel on the side of his command chair, calling up the starboard cameras onto the main view screen. 4 staccato lines of red-orange plasma streaked away from just below the camera toward the distant black and crimson frigate a few hundred meters away from them. The enemy frigate's shields flashed repeatedly as they absorbed the energy of the incoming fire, but with each impact their flash became less distinct.
"Target is losing her starboard shields,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported.
"Jump missile impact,"
Jessica reported.
"1 more gunship down,"
Lieutenant Commander Kono added.
"The other 2 jumped away just before missile impact."
"Losing the angle on the broadsides,"
Lieutenant Deneuve warned from the helm.
"Captain, flight reports all birds are engaged with Dusan octofighters in the vicinity of the platform and over the Rani plant,"
the comms officer reported.
"Combat, Captain, cease fire,"
Nathan ordered over his comm set. "Helm, yaw to starboard. Bring our mains onto the frigate."
"Target is turning to get a clear jump line,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona warned.
"Yawing to starboard,"
Lieutenant Deneuve reported.
"Gunyoki are unable to engage Frigate One,"
the comms officer added.
"They're too busy defending themselves against those octos,"
Jessica commented. "Launch another 8 Super Eagles," Nathan ordered.
"Aye, sir,"
the comms officer acknowledged.
"Frigate 2 has a clear jump line,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona warned.
"She's spooling up her jump drive."
"Let them go,"
Nathan decided. "Helm, adjust attitude to bring all forward tubes onto Frigate 1.
"Adjusting attitude to fire on Frigate 1, aye,"
Lieutenant Deneuve replied as she continued to bring the Aurora's nose around while the ship drifted away from the targets.
"Frigate 2 has jumped,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported.
"Range to Frigate 1 is increasing,"
Jessica warned.
"Max effective range in 20 seconds.
"You should have a firing solution in 10,
Lieutenant Deneuve assured Jessica.
8 more Super Eagles are away,"
the comms officer reported. "Forward tubes, max power triplets," Nathan instructed. "Fire when ready."
"Forward tubes, max power triplets,"
Jessica repeated.
"Firing."
A barrage of red-orange balls of plasma streaked away from the Aurora, slamming into the unshielded frigate 3 seconds later. The target broke in half and erupted in multiple explosions, sending debris flying in all directions.
"Frigate One is destroyed,"
Jessica stated with obvious satisfaction.
"I've got the second frigate,"
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported.
2 light seconds out, coming about a bit slowly."
"They're turning to jump back into the platform,"
Jessica surmised.
"Recommend we leave something behind for them."
Comms warn all ships that were dropping mines at position 147 by 15. 5x5 spread, Nathan ordered.
Aye, sir,
the comms officer replied. Deploying smart mines, Jessica acknowledged, a small smile on her face. Helm, turn into that frigate. Jump us just to her starboard side so she thinks we're preparing to attack her.
Aye, sir,
Lieutenant Denev replied.
Nice,
Jessica commented, appreciating the captain's tactics.
On course as ordered,
Lieutenant Denev reported.
Jump us to that frigate, Nathan ordered.
Jumping, aye,
Mr. Bickle replied as the jump flash washed over the bridge.
Jump complete.
Nathan turned toward a sensor officer to his left, waiting.
Locking jump missiles on the frigate,
Jessica reported, just to sell it a bit.
Target is jumping, sir,
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported, a hint of pleasure in her tone. The bridge suddenly became quiet as everyone waited to see if the captain's ploy had worked. 3 seconds later, they found out.
Multiple explosions,
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported.
Frigate 2 jumped right into the minefield, Captain. They've lost main power and all our shields are down.
Shall I come about to jump in and finish her off, sir?
Lieutenant Denev wondered. Negative, Nathan replied. Get us back to a position halfway between the platform and Rakuin. Comms tell the gun yokies near the race platform to finish off that frigate while our super eagles keep those octofighters occupied.
Aye, sir,
the comms officer acknowledged.
On course and ready to jump,
Lieutenant Denev announced.
Jump us over, Nathan ordered.
Jumping,
the navigator announced as the jump flash washed over the bridge yet again.
Jump complete.
Any sign of those gunships over the Rani plant? Nathan asked.
Negative, sir,
Lieutenant Commander Kona replied.
Captain Rakuin Defense Command reports the Dusan octofighters over the Rani plant have jumped away and have yet to return.
Very well.
The gunyokis are tearing up Frigate 2, Lieutenant Commander Kona reported. The remaining octos around the platform are jumping away as well.
Comms have flight-maintained patrols over both engagement areas, Nathan ordered,
and send the Raptors on system perimeter patrol to check for any other Dusan ships that might be lurking on the fringes of the system.
Yes, sir,
the comms officer replied.
Frigate 2 is coming apart,
Lieutenant Commander Kona reported.
Frigate 2 is destroyed.
We could have finished off that frigate with a pair of jump missiles,
Jessica commented, even from all the way out here.
Yeah, but then the gunyoki wouldn't have gotten their first big kill, Nathan replied, a small grin on his face.
Chapter 8
The guests began arriving at the Scott family's Vancouver estate just before sundown in a never-ending stream of black limousines. To the untrained observer, security appeared almost non-existent, with no more than polite men and women wearing appropriate dress attire, checking guests through the main gates, and helping them find their dining tables in the vast south lawn of the sprawling compound. Crispin-born Ned saw something entirely different. Security was everywhere, as were sound and weapons suppression fields. More than half of the service staff were armed members of the NAU security detail, assigned to protect not only the president, but numerous dignitaries in attendance. In addition, many of those dignitaries had their own bodyguards. There were ushers everywhere, most of whom were standing on the sidelines, offering the occasional courteous directions to confused guests. In addition, there were trained snipers on the rooftops of not only the Scott estate, but the two estates to the south and east, both of which had a clear line of sight into the event. As Crispin moved slowly through the crowd, offering hors d'oeuvres to guests, he kept his eyes peeled for anything out of the ordinary. He had yet to be contacted by the operative Mr. Dakota had mentioned. The event was now in full swing, and soon the president would be giving his customary Founders Day speech. It would be the one moment the president would be in the open, assuming his handler's promise that the target's shields would be deactivated was true. His tray emptied, Crispin returned to the catering tent on the side of the south lawn to pick up another one. As he had already done a dozen times this night, he placed his empty tray on the table as he entered and moved toward the table containing freshly stocked trays waiting to be taken out.
Martin!
One of the waitstaff supervisors barked. Crispin responded immediately upon hearing his cover name called.
"Yes, sir,"
he replied, stepping over to the man who had called him.
"Take that tray to the guard station on the third floor southeast bedroom,"
the supervisor instructed as he scanned Crispin's ID badge. Crispin looked at the handheld scanner, purposefully appearing puzzled.
"What's that for?"
"So the guards don't shoot you," the supervisor joked. "Deliver the food, then wait outside the door until he is finished so you can bring back his tray."
"But that could take a while," Crispin said.
"You got a problem taking a break?"
"I've barely earned 100 credits in tips,"
Crispin complained, trying to appear eager to earn tips like everyone else. "Don't worry," the supervisor told him. "The real money starts flowing after the president's speech. That's when everyone starts drinking and the party really gets rolling."
"Yes, sir," Crispin replied, picking up the tray of food.
"How do I get to the..."
"Third floor southeast bedroom," the supervisor repeated. "Out the back of the tent, through the kitchen and down the hallway. Elevator up to the third floor. The guard on the third floor will direct you from there."
Crispin was about to depart with a tray of food when something dawned on him. "How will I know when the guard is finished?"
"Keep your ears open," the supervisor said with a wink. His expression suddenly turned deadly serious.
"You will know when he is down."
It wasn't a slip of the tongue. Crispin had just met the other operative. President Scott stood at the picture window in his study, staring at the sea of lights in the city beyond his family estate. He had gazed out this window countless times in his 81 years of life. He remembered when he would look out this window with his father, and his father before him, when the lights below were far more sparse. Even 5 years ago, the lights had been sparse. Earth's recovery had taken time, but now, 7 years after the ceasefire, his hard work had finally paid off. The recovery of his beloved Earth was nearly complete. Once again, the lights below were a blazing symbol of prosperity, accomplishment, and anticipation of things still to come. So much had changed over the last 9 years. So much had been lost. He remembered the words of his grandfather. "A generation must die for its successor to come into its own." He wondered how many of those who had died had made way for their successors. His wife, his eldest son, his youngest daughter's husband. All of their deaths had forced others to step up. His youngest son had become the leader Dayton had always known he would be. His daughter had stepped up and become an indispensable member of his administration. And their stories were not unique. He knew of countless individuals who had been forced to step up to fill the voids left by the untimely passing of others. Millions had perished so that trillions more could survive and thrive. Dayton Scott's earliest childhood memories were those of his world's first ventures into orbit, since the biodigital plague had sent them back to the horse and buggy age. Now his youngest son was leading an interstellar rebellion 1,000 light-years away. His father had been correct. Times had indeed changed.
"What are you doing hiding in here?" Miri asked as she entered the room.
"Just looking out the window and thinking," her father responded.
"About what?"
"Hope," he mused. He looked at her and smiled. "You remind me so much of your mother."
"Are you ready for this?" she asked.
"Of course not," he admitted with a sigh. "You know, every year I make a Founders Day speech, and every year I think it's the most important speech I will ever make. For once it may actually be."
"Are you sure you want to do this?" Miri wondered, sensing her father's apprehension. "No one would blame you if you played it safe. Like you said, you can do more for the people of Earth by staying in office."
"Miri, through the course of my life, I've had to do many things I was not proud of. Every time I convinced myself that I was doing them for the greater good. Yet every single one of them, even the ones that turned out the way I'd hoped, still haunt me to this day.
But
whether I am to succeed or fail, if I do either one using the truth, my conscience will be clear."
Miri leaned forward and kissed her father on the cheek. "Have I ever told you how proud I am to be your daughter?"
"Not as proud as I am to be your father," he replied, wrapping his arms around her.
The door opened and a man in a black tuxedo stepped inside.
"It's time, Mr. President."
Dayton took a deep breath and sighed.
"Time to make some enemies," he said, heading for the door.
The guard on the third floor gave Crispin far more attention than any guard thus far. Unlike the plainclothes guards in the public areas, these men were in uniform, including flak vests, helmets, and heavy assault-style plasma rifles. In short, they were dressed for war. After several minutes of checking his ID, performing bioscans, and checking in with his unit commander, the guard allowed him to pass. Crispin offered the man a biscuit, but he was not interested. Crispin followed the guard's directions to the end of the corridor and around the corner. He found the door to the southeast bedroom and knocked 3 times, then twice, then 3 more times, just as the guard at the elevator had instructed. The door opened and he was met by a square-jawed Marine in full body armor, the same type Crispin had worn himself during his time in the service.
"Where would you like this?" Crispin asked.
"Over there on the desk,"
the Marine instructed, turning back to his duties at the window.
Crispin glanced about as he placed the tray of food on the table. There were two Marines in the room, both of whom had assault rifles. The guard who had answered the door was the spotter and was actively scanning the crowd below for any suspicious behavior. The second Marine had a sniper rifle trained on the crowd, as well as the stage, and was constantly checking his range to various locations. These men were safeties, usually referred to as overwatch, since their primary functions were to watch the scene they were assigned to protect. If a shooter were to suddenly start firing from the crowd, from another building, or from anywhere within their line of fire, their job was to take that shooter out as quickly as possible, without concern for collateral damage. "High Boy 4, check in," the encrypted comms box on the nightstand next to the spotter squawked. "High Boy 4, all clear," the spotter replied. "How much time before Delta Sierra?" "Why, you need to piss or something?" "Food's here." 10 minutes, the voice on the comms box replied. "Eat quick." "Will there be anything else?" Crispin asked. "We're good, thanks," the spotter replied without taking his eyes off the crowd. Crispin took one last look around the room as well as a peek out the window. The shooter had a perfect shot at the stage, from high right, giving him a 1/4 profile of the target. For Crispin, it would be an easy shot, as long as the president's shields were disabled as promised. The big question would be how to escape once the target was eliminated. As with every Founders Day celebration before, tonight's was under a clear, star-filled summer's night. The air was crisp, with a slight breeze which caused the decorations to sway seductively, as the orchestra played a mixture of selections designed to cater to all ages. When the current selection finished, the orchestra began the presidential anthem, and the spotlight snapped to life, focused on the stairs leading from the Scott House to the South Lawn, where the partygoers were assembled. President Scott stepped out of the doors at the very moment the overture ended, and the first verse began to play. He was met with the usual respectful applause given to the elected leader of the Union, the world, and the Alliance. The intensity of the applause increased as the president walked down the steps, waving as he made his way to the main stage, where his daughters and their husbands all stood waiting, applauding their father as well. The president moved across the stage, shaking the hands of the dignitaries chosen to share it with him this night. He paused by his four daughters, giving each of them a kiss on the cheek. Finally, he arrived at the podium where he spent several minutes waving to the crowd, even after the music had stopped, waiting for the applause to die down before beginning the most important speech of his career. "Thank you," he said, repeating himself several times while he waited for their cheers to fade. "Happy Founders Day," he yelled, whipping them back into a thunderous applause. He continued waving at the crowd another full minute before their cheers finally died down enough for him to be heard once again. "I'm happy you're all enjoying yourselves. It's an important day in the history of our world, and it should be celebrated." The president looked around the crowd as the last of the applause fell silent. "In fact, it's an important day for the entire Corps. Without the founders of the Ark Institute, the Earth and her Corps worlds would not be enjoying the very freedoms we celebrate this night." The crowd erupted in applause once again, forcing the president to wait before launching into the main body of his speech. Crispin sat patiently on the settee in the hallway outside the southeast bedroom, the tray in his lap, waiting for some signal to enter the room. The operative who gave him the tray of food had offered little in the way of instructions. However, at the time, there were plenty of people within earshot. The entire exchange still bothered him. Were he the operative, Crispin would have taken the time to ensure that proper instructions were given to the asset. Poor communication can kill the best-laid plans. He was taught that in basic. Yet the assignment details had been unclear from day one. From his handler to this operative, Crispin had been left guessing more than necessary. Something suddenly occurred to him. The tray on his lap seemed heavy in comparison to those he had carried all evening. Not by much, but definitely heavier. He had originally attributed it to the tray likely being of a different maker. Perhaps the metal was thicker, or the tray was slightly larger. But upon closer examination, neither was true. The tray was exactly the same, except for one thing. It was not made of metal. At least the face of it was not. That's when he noticed something else. The face of the tray was removable. After checking to ensure that no cameras were trained on him, Crispin removed the white glove from his right hand, worked his fingernail under the edge of the tray face, and lifted it up. The tray face was light, probably made of some type of carbon fiber or nanotube structure. After putting his glove back on, he lifted the face, peeking underneath. The space between the tray face and the tray bottom was filled with a lightweight material, with a small cutout on one side. Crispin recognized the material as the same type used to protect comms gear from detection or electronic countermeasures. Within the cutout was a small electronic device. Crispin removed the device, immediately recognizing it as a comms jammer. Its miniature size meant its range and battery life were likely limited. Furthermore, its very presence was troubling. Why didn't the operative tell me about this? Crispin quickly analyzed the situation. Things weren't adding up, and the only reasons he could come up with bothered him. But it was too late now. He was in too deep. He had to act. Crispin activated the comms jammer and put it in his pocket. He then rose and knocked on the door. When it opened, the guard before him looked confused. Not confused by Crispin's knocking, but rather by his own wooziness and inability to focus. "What do you want?" the guard asked. "You don't look so good," Crispin said, easing the man back a few steps so he could enter the room and close the door behind him. "Mike!" the guard called to his cohort. Crispin glanced at the shooter who was slumped over his weapon. "Mike!" the guard repeated. He grabbed his comm box from the table, calling into it. "Control, High Boy 4, my shooter's down and something is wrong with me." The guard looked at Crispin. "You, what did you do?" Just as he began to put two and two together, Crispin's food tray smacked him in the face, knocking him backward onto the bed. Crispin pulled the man's sidearm and placed it into his belt under his white jacket, then checked the guard's pulse. The man was alive. Whatever had been put into the food had obviously been designed to incapacitate but not kill. Although Crispin did not care to kill a fellow Marine, this too seemed suspicious. A hit as monumental as this called for extreme measures. The effect of incapacitating drugs could not be accurately predicted. An instantly lethal poison would have made more sense. If Gagliardi is willing to kill the president, surely he's willing to sacrifice a few Marines along the way. Crispin had no time to debate the issue. He had one chance at freedom for himself and his beloved Sarah, and that chance was slipping away with each passing second. The president was already halfway through his speech, and once completed he would be on the move, surrounded by guests, making a decent shot improbable. Crispin checked the shooter next. He too had a pulse. Crispin pulled him away from the window, taking the soldier's sniper rifle in his left hand, as he shoved the unconscious shooter onto the floor and out of his way. While he moved into position, he reached into his pocket and deactivated the comms jammer. If anybody called for High Boy 4, he would have to answer, or the guard at the third-floor elevator would come busting through the door a minute later. Crispin raised the sniper rifle and took aim, immediately focusing on the president at the podium. A touch of the sensor display control pad on the side of the weapon told him that Mr. Dakota had kept his promise. The president's weapons shield, although active, was at minimal power. It would not stop a high-powered needle beam from his sniper rifle. As he took aim and prepared to fire, he noticed movement on the stage to the right of the president. A woman had moved to the side, as if attempting to exit the stage for some reason. Crispin breathed in and out, slow and steady. He could feel his heart beating in his chest, and could hear the air moving through his nostrils. He was about to kill the leader of the Earth and of the Alliance. He was about to go down in history in a way that no sane man would ever want. He was doing it for Sarah. Crispin's finger moved smoothly from the trigger guard to the trigger itself. But as he tensed his finger, something happened. A blinding flash of light filled his targeting scope, and a loud boom shook the windows and the building itself. Crispin's eyes widened. He lowered his sniper rifle to look at the stage below with naked eyes, but it was gone. More accurately, it was veiled behind a wall of smoke. What the fuck? A bomb? Someone set off a bomb? Crispin suddenly realized he wasn't the only asset in play. In fact, he might even be the decoy. Shit! Crispin exclaimed in frustration. The comms box was ablaze with comms traffic. Screams of panic from the crowd below filled the air. Crispin raised his weapon again, using his target scope to scan the area where the stage had been. As the evening breeze pushed the smoke aside, he began to catch small glimpses of the scene. The stage was a mess. Most of it had collapsed, and there was a smoking hole where the president had been a moment ago. To the right were the mutilated bodies of the president's daughters and their husbands. To the left, what little remained of those dignitaries unlucky enough to have been invited to share the stage with the president that night. Rescue personnel and presidential security were already swarming over the bodies, trying to determine if the president,
if anyone, was still alive. The door burst open behind him. Crispin spun around and opened fire as the guard from the elevator fired on him. Three bolts of energy streaked by Crispin's head, slamming into the wall behind him. Crispin rolled to his left,